History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, one thing is certain. There are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the time to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors, and more importantly, be patient enough to listen to what comes back our way, we are not going to regret it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And we always come out ahead in that process because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 76 years ago right now, the battle for an 8-square-mile hunk of volcanic land in the Pacific was about halfway through. Some initial estimates had suggested it might take just 3 days to capture Iwo Jima, but that was before they realized that the 11 miles of tunnels on that island had been largely unaffected by the pre-invasion bombardment. And by this point, 76 years ago, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th Marine Divisions had all suffered heavy casualties. You're going to hear about the Battle of Iwo Jima today through the memories of men who experienced it in different roles. And we're also going to tell you about one opportunity you have this month to honor the memory of the more than 6,800 Americans killed there, not to mention the more than 19,000 wounded. You're going to hear from someone who was wounded and about some who paid the ultimate price to secure what would become critical airstrips for American bombers in the latter stages of World War II. I want you to get a little perspective from veterans from each branch of service. The Marines, of course, who are most associated with Iwo Jima, but also Army, Navy, Army Air Corps, and Coast Guard. We'll start with a Navy man. Steve Marusich was a rear-facing gunner in a TBF Avenger torpedo bomber flying off of the escort carrier USS Bismarck Sea.
Well, I tell you, everyone was excited because it was the biggest fleet of ships I'd ever seen. There were hundreds of ships in the area, battleships, cruisers, heavy cruisers, destroyers, big carriers, and there were about a dozen of us little guys. And we were there for almost a week, and it was our responsibility to fly over the island and drop our bombs and try to make things difficult for the Japanese to get ready so that the Marines could come ashore.
When you say you'd never seen a bigger fleet, a bigger group of ships, when you got to Iwo Jima and you saw so much firepower on the American side, did you ever think, we need all this for this little island? Is that something that occurred to you?
Yes, I was surprised that the Japanese were so well fortified. They had to be all underground because that island was sure peppered every day for 6 or 7 days. The big 16-inch guns from the battleships and the big carriers had much more firepower than we did, but that was our duty to just go and drop bombs on the island and see if you could soften them up.
And when you were flying those missions and dropping bomb after bomb and knowing all these other planes were too, did you see anything down below that made you think that this was going to be much of a fight?
No, it didn't look that ominous. It was just an island with very little vegetation. And we kept wondering why the heck we were there, because it didn't look like there was much on the island to be fighting for. Although later on I found out that that airstrip was vital to the B-29s to hit Tokyo. So that was our mission, to see if we can't soften it up and maybe give the Marines a better chance to get the island.
For people who haven't been there, and I think most of us listening have not been to Iwo Jima, we've certainly seen pictures of the giant mound, Mount Suribachi on one end of the island, and then more of a flat strip going from there. What did it look like to you, and certainly from the air? Was there something striking about that location?
Nothing striking other than Suribachi at one end, and it looked like a real simple thing to get that island, but when you found out that there were thousands of Japanese underground, and the Marines had a heck of a time getting there because there was very little foliage or shrubs or anything to cover. So when they invaded that island, those Marines were outstanding and to be able to get those Japanese out of there.
And early on in that invasion, Steve, after your primary job of hitting the island before the invasion was done, there was a bit of a commotion aboard your carrier. What was that all about?
On the day that we met the enemy, my shipmate and I were sitting on the hangar deck aft on the starboard side, and we were getting ready to go eat. It was about 6:30 at night. And as we were sitting there talking, ready to go and to start our chow that night, why, the guns start firing off and the general quarter sounded. And we stood up and turned towards the bow of the ship. And just as we turned, the first suicide plane hit us about, 20 or 30 feet in, on the starboard side where my shipmate and I were standing. And we were blown down the hangar deck about, I would say maybe 20, 30 feet. And the explosion hit me in the back of the head and my back, my legs. And after laying there a few seconds, I got up and started walking towards the bow of the ship. And not walking very well, I was kind of wondering if my legs were broken or not. Anyway, by the time I got up forward about another 20, 30 yards, the second suicide plane came down and hit our above our after elevator and knocked our torpedoes off, and the torpedoes began exploding, and the ship was damaged very severely. And another half a minute or so, the skipper came on and told us to abandon ship. Moving forward, I went up to the forward gun sponson where there were, I think, 20-millimeter cannons. They had a big line over the side, and I was fortunate I got up that far, took my helmet off. My jacket was gone. It was blown off my back. And I went over the side on the big line, and after dropping a few feet, we're up about 45, 50 feet, and one of the shipmates above me was stepping on my hands. So I let go of the rope and went down about 25 feet and hit the water and started floating and swimming away from the ship. After that, we started congregating out in the sea. And because the Japanese were still in the area, the other ships couldn't turn their lights on because the Japs were still strafing us in the water and still firing at ships. So it was about 4 hours later that they began to pick us up and the lights came on, and they pulled me aboard a destroyer escort, and they picked up almost 400 of us, and I was fortunate to be put aboard the destroyer. We were given some alcohol nourishment. Most of us were very cold and had very little energy, and we took all our clothes off. They gave us new clothes. And the sailors on board that destroyer escort were very helpful in pulling all of us aboard and giving us some alcohol, either it was brandy or some other thing to take the chill off our bodies. And in those days, I wasn't familiar with that alcohol, so it was quite an exciting to get such heat in your stomach. So the next day, they took us into Iwo Jima and put us on a big transport and made it into a hospital ship. And it was right below Mount Suribachi. And later that morning, the skipper came on and announced to all of us, if they would look up on the mountain, you'll see the flag flying. And the flag went up on Iwo Jima, the one that most people in World War II recognize as a victory symbol for those Americans who wanted us to be successful in the war.
And I've heard a lot of stories that people have about where they were when they saw that flag go up, and it has symbolic value for just about everyone. But I imagine for you, as someone who's just had your ship sunk and you were almost killed, to see something like that probably had a lot of symbolic value for you.
It was very emotional to all of those sailors that were around me. They all were so enthused, and we're so happy that the Americans went up on that mountain and the Japs were still in that mountain because they were shooting at us in the harbor, and the Marines still got up there and put that flag up there, and the symbol of our flag sure is a freedom symbol to all the people of the world. I think we just can't imagine how much it means to us to see the flag flying and to know we're still free.
But what did that flag atop Mount Suribachi mean to the Marines fighting on Iwo Jima? Let's hear that perspective from Peter Rondero, who had turned 19 a month earlier and was one of the first Marines to land at Iwo Jima.
I know our platoon was right in the middle next to Hill 362. All of a sudden, there's all this noise. He said, what's going on? And by that time, my sergeant calls me. He says, hey, Pete, come over here. Look at the flag. The flag, yeah. So I looked up, and here it is, flying a Mount Suribachi. Wow, when I saw that, I got goose pimples. I almost cried, and I said, gee, it's almost over. It was really a sight because you could hear the horns of the ships and people firing their weapons, and everybody hear me screaming, really. It's one of the most happiest moments in our lives, but we forgot that there was a price we had to pay for it. In the Marine Corps, you learn a lot of things, and one of the things is that when you're going to reach your objective, you just got to charge, period. And if you get hurt, somebody's going to take care of you, the corpsmen, and they do a beautiful job. They make a decision whether how bad you are, and either you're taken to the beach or you're put aside and somebody will take care of you, period. I always thought, if I'm going to die, please give me a wound that won't hurt, and God bless whatever happens, you know. Mm-hmm. But I always did think of my family, my mother, my brothers and sisters. But we're supposed to be hardcore men and not think about things like that. But I'll tell you the truth, we all thought about our families, but we always did hope for that million-dollar wound that would take us off the island. It so happens I was assigned to Fox Company, 2nd Battalion, 27th Marine, and our destination was Red Beach 1, and we happened to be in the first wave.
The very first wave on the
very island. First wave. It's all like the book says. We had those walls of sand we had to crawl over and dash across the narrow neck of the island, right above, below, Mount Suribachi, and head north. There was a lot of casualties. It's just awful. I was scared, really. I was scared. But seeing my buddies getting hit and wounded, I had to go forward. We had to reach our objective, regardless of the causes, because that was what the plans were. Was supposed to be a 72-hour operation and turned out to be 36 days. At Quinto Point was cliffs, caves, and we would send out feelers. In other words, we send maybe a platoon or a company to see how the enemy was dug in. It so happens in our line, we were told to go check on a cliff and see how's everything go over there. So we went. And this fellow by the name Mike Ladich were advancing and pooping and peeking, and all of a sudden I see this movement. So I took aim and I shot, and I could see somebody go back. And I said, oh my God, I killed somebody. Not knowing who they were, but I mean, we knew it was the enemy. And I made a mistake. I didn't roll. I over to the left or right. And about that time I went to see what it was like in Wango. I got hit, and I passed out for a few seconds, and I grabbed my rifle and I started going back, and Mike looks at me and says, hey, you're wounded. I didn't feel anything but the blood just coming down, and a facial wound is bleeds easily, but there's a shock, and you don't feel anything.
You got hit,
yeah,
in the helmet, right?
Yeah, and it went between the steel helmet and the fiber, and it went ricocheting right around and right. Oh, if it wasn't.
It went between the steel helmet and the liner, which
yeah,
kind of like a chute for it to come right out.
Yeah,
the back
ricocheted
of the helmet
right around, yeah, and it almost ripped my ear off. So that was it, and I went to the corner with Paul Bradford. He looks at me and says, you're all right. He sprinkled a bit of sulfur powder and put a Band-Aid on. I said, go back to the front lines. Here I am. Oh, no kidding. Here I thought I was going to get shipped out, you know.
It wasn't quite $1 million.
No, it was not. It was a 2-bits wound. It wasn't dead center. If it was dead center, that would have gone. I would have been a goner. But after a few days, we went back to get some supplies. And you can see the stacks of rifles, stacks of helmets. And I looked at it and says, I'm not the only one that got hit like that. You know, there was a lot of helmets with the bullets right through them. So I was pretty lucky. I was very fortunate. But there's times when you think about who's the one that didn't come back. And you say, gee, you get a guilty feeling because, like I say, I came home and I had a family and job and everything. And I say, gee, see, here's where I'm getting all messed up. You think about your friends, you know, of them missing life, the blessings.
Nearly 7,000 Americans died in that 36-day battle for Iwo Jima. It is their memory that will be honored March 20th in a special honor walk organized by the Best Defense Foundation. You can participate wherever you are. In the past, that foundation, led by former All-Pro linebacker Donnie Edwards, has returned veterans to Iwo Jima to visit some of the very spots where they risked their lives. Given the pandemic, that isn't possible this year, but the Honor Walk is a great way to recognize the sacrifice of so many and to educate younger generations about the price that was paid there. You can sign up online at bdf.org, and I also have that link for you at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, we're going to pick up more perspective on what happened there from another Marine, yes, but also a man who had to fly a general into Iwo Jima in the thick of the battle, as well as someone who witnessed it all from a ship just offshore. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we reflect on the Battle of Iwo Jima through the eyes of men who at this time 76 years ago were still contending for control of those 8 square miles in the Pacific. Before we hear Army Air Corps and Navy perspectives of the battle, let's hear from another Marine, Umbert Cantelmi.
I thought I was in a nightmare because shells were falling all over, artillery and mortars and everything. And if you didn't get down, you would probably be chewed up with the mortar shells, you know. There were so many that were killed that way with the mortars.
And probably killed not too far from you, on your left and on your right.
Oh, yeah. There was bodies that were just dead Marines piled up for removal, you know. I don't know, for burial, I guess. And then a lot of the guys were, I don't know what they say. They said the first 72 hours, 2 out of 3 were hit, either wounded or killed.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't put you in very good odds.
No. You wonder when it's going to be. You mean it might be any time. So I just happened to be moving at the spot that the mortar dropped where I was standing or moving along. And like one time that the Japanese would launch these big rockets. They were rockets. They think they put them on They had no accuracy, but they landed on somewhere on the island, and they had to kill somebody. We were moving forward, and we're setting up for the night. We have these demolition guys. They come ahead of us and set these trip flares. So they hit these trip flares, and then you can see them silhouetted. But anyway, my squad leader said, just settle in this shell hole here. And he said he would come in with me, but till he got his squad set up. And then he come by and says, you better move out of it because someone else is coming here. There was little knoll in the back, about 50 feet or so. And I started digging the foxhole there. I was about probably knee deep, about ready to, you don't dig very far. You just got to get covered.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those rockets landed right in the hole. I was just left. So, and there's other, close calls. I had to watch a cave one time as they were moving forward and see if any, the enemy coming out of the caves or the ones. And after a while, they were getting up there a little way, so I decided I had to get up with them. Just as I'm out of range of I looked back and a mortar landed right there. So I just, it just happened to be, I guess the Lord was with me.
He is certainly not the only one who felt that way. The Iwo Jima memories we're going to hear next are from Jesse Dudley, who had trained as a bomber pilot but drew the task of becoming a personal pilot for General Mickey Moore, leader of the 7th Fighter Command. Dudley delivered the general to Iwo Jima in an unarmed B-24.
And we landed there at D+3. The Japanese were still fighting the Marines, and we got their attention when I landed with the B-24. I guess they hadn't seen one that close up before. But the 51s all landed ahead of me. We had a very uneventful flight. It took a few days to get there, but no problems whatsoever.
No problems whatsoever, but from what I hear, there were actually bullets flying across the runway when you put that B-24 down.
Absolutely, yes, it sure was.
Well, yeah. We got to question your definition of uneventful here.
I think they were awed by the sight of the airplane, and they just looked like they were kind of standing there with their jaws hanging. And, of course, I didn't stay very long. The runway was kind of short and temporary, and I ran off the end of it with the B-24, but it was nice and solid. It wasn't sand like most of the island. Made a quick turnaround and got back up to safety.
So you ran off the end of the runway. You said that very matter-of-factly. That sounds like that could be potentially hairy to me.
Well, it was mostly hard-packed dirt or whatever it was. Anyhow, I was a little surprised, too, that made a quick turnaround right there off the end of the runway and back. All the 51s had landed safely ahead of me, so.
Well, I think it's safe to say it's probably a lot easier to land a P-51 there than a B-24.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely.
I'm sure you're focused on just getting that plane down and accomplishing your mission, but as you were flying in, did you see anything that sticks with you today as far as the scene you were looking at and what was happening on that small volcanic island?
Suribachi. That was going to be home to me. We had our headquarters and our living quarters right at the base of Suribachi, which was still in the hands of the Japanese. It wasn't secured for quite some time after we got there. They had booby traps all over the island, like new lumber stacked up, and if you had tried to take it, it would have blown up, things like that.
And so you were there just 3 days after that invasion started, that's about how long the military expected it to last, but it lasted a lot longer than that.
It sure did, yes. Yes, the Marines were quite surprised on the landing, yes.
Well, and I imagine you saw quite a bit, even though your duties were not the same as what the Marines were doing. You probably experienced and witnessed some pretty vivid experiences there.
Oh, yes, yes. We could see Suribachi. It was right outside our tent. As a matter of fact, we were also worried about nighttime. We were trying to dig under our cots, but the sand was so, I can't think of the word. In other words, it kept filling up the hole that we were digging. We did have some of our pilots that were killed during the night. The Japanese sneaked into the tent and slit their throat. So it was quite discomforting to live there.
That was pilot Jesse Dudley, who would later have the chance to count the Emperor of Japan as one of his passengers. If you want to hear that story, you can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where, again, you can also sign up for the Best Defense Foundation Iwo Jima Honor Walk that will take place everywhere March 20th. 76 years ago, Delton Wally Walling, who had been at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and survived 3.5 years of war since then, was watching everything unfold at Iwo Jima from his ship just offshore.
And it's the first time that we saw the P-51 Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoon, here comes an awful roar of planes coming towards us about 50 or 60 feet off in the water. You can't see them.
But you can hear them.
You can hear them. And all at once we look out there, man, here they're coming. Well, hell, we're going for sure. And then they come by us and come up and make the rolls, and it's the P-51 Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
See, the airstrip is secured. That's the first time that I saw the P-51 Mustang. Boy, I thought that was the hottest thing. Well, it was, up to the P-38 Lockheed Lightning.
And I'm just imagining, as you describe that moment, that you hear these planes coming, you think you're about to die, and then you see that they're American planes. So it goes from the worst to the best in a split second, huh?
In a split second, yeah. Yeah. You see, I want to tell another story. Sergeant Bassalone, you know who he is.
One of the heroes of Iwo Jima.
He is a hero of Iwo Jima, but he was the first Medal of Honor at Guadalcanal. Because when the battle stopped in the morning at Guadalcanal, he had 32 dead in front of his pillbox. His gun is gone. His ammunition man is dead. He's the only one alive. Well, then we was able to hold 100. And then they took him back to the States and made a poster boy out of him.
Right.
He was the first Medal of Honor winner of the Marines in the Pacific War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was back there over a year or so, and he sold more bonds than any other man alive.
All the war bonds. He was the example that they used to sell.
But all the time, he wanted to go back
right to
his men. So as we was coming, the squadron of ships is going to Iwo Jima. We picked him up at Guam, and he happened to come aboard my ship. So he was with us in the chief's quarters on this trip. So I got to know him real well on that little short trip. At Iwo Jima, we put him with his unit. He was on the third wave. The first two are dead. The men on the first two waves are dead or wounded. And when he came in with his, he saw that ahead of him and hollered to his men, "You're going to die if you don't run across that beach. Get across that beach. Don't stop. Do anything you can to get across." He hit them on the head. He called them bad names, everything, just to keep motivated to get them off there. Him and another sergeant. And he got killed 500 yards in there right next to the airstrip. I knew that young man. He was a wonderful young man. Sergeant Bassalone. So at Iwo Jima, then they gave him the Navy Cross. Those kids that followed him off in that boat that day would have followed him anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you were ready to.
Well, I would have. See, I'm only laying off about 400 yards off in the beach, and I'm taking back the casualties from that beach. That's why I had all of them aboard. I'm the first ship that took back the casualties.
So the Higgins boats, the LCVPs, would go from your ship to the shore to take troops in. They would also bring the casualties back.
If they could. Not every boat could take them back.
Right.
Because they're under fire.
But there was a day there at Iwo where you guys received over 400 casualties back on your ship?
I had. By 10 o'clock in the morning, on the morning of the invasion, I had 400 back aboard.
Wow. What kind of shape are these guys in?
They're either dead or just any kind. You see, Mount Sarabachi was 3/4 of a mile away. And the whole side of that mountain, it faces the beach. And so over time of 20 years of them fortifying, they knew every foot of that beach. They had to calibrate it from every one of those beach holes up in that mountain.
All the caves and tunnels in Suribachi.
That's right. So all they had to do was wait so many troops and kill them. And that was what was happening the day of the raid.
And you're watching this.
I'm watching. See, on the bridge, you got the big glasses.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, of course, I watched the flags go up on Iwo Jima.
And you said it right. You said flags, not flag. So you saw the first flag go up, and you saw it replaced by a second larger flag. Did that mean something to you at the time while you're looking
from your ship? Oh, my God. You know, of course, we don't know how far on shore that the Marines have got. But when we see, we're making progress because now we've chopped off the thing that's giving us so much damage.
Mm-hmm.
And right ahead of us was the little boat basin, and our tanks in those days are small stuff. So we're watching the advance. It took them 7 days and only a few hundred yards that they could get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because, man, those tanks would start up and go a few yards and blow bottom side up. It was so fortified that those men, I don't know how in the world they ever advanced on Iwo Jima.
I get the sense, and I could be wrong, but just kind of reading between the lines here as I listen to you, it almost sounds like watching the Marines on Iwo Jima was more difficult for you than what you saw December 7th.
Right. You see, I tell everybody, December 7th was bad, and we lost up to 3,000 people, civilians and military personnel. But every island in the Pacific, we lost more than that. Why don't we think more of these islands where these kids died than just Pearl Harbor all the time? But Pearl Harbor had to get us in the war.
Yeah. And Pearl Harbor, you didn't know it was coming.
No.
But Iwo Jima, these are guys who have been on your ship that you're watching go to shore, and then you're watching them get killed moments later.
Yeah.
As you watch helplessly through those glasses, right? Yeah. Do I have it right?
Yeah.
And there's the story. You picked up a light, some Morse code signals of a boat coming back to your ship?
That was opening day at Iwo Jima. That was one of those small landing crafts about 25, 30 feet long that had the big steel con in the center of it.
Uh-huh.
Just all at once. Here's a erratic lights flashing at me at our ship. And so I hollered to the captain below that this ship was trying to get hold. He says, see if you can find out what he wants. He finally got to me that he wanted to come aboard because his craft is sinking. I hollered to the captain. He says, get him aboard. So the guy came up there to me, and one man is hanging over the side dead. The other one, the one who was sending me the message, has got his other arm blew off. The armor that he uses for signaling. The left one is one he's sending the message to me, and he can't hardly send it.
So his right arm was blown off on Iwo Jima. The other guys on this boat are dead, and he's using his left arm
right
to signal you while his boat is sinking.
And so he comes along. They throw the lines on the boat, and they rush down there and take off everybody, and the boat sinks right beside us right there.
Wow. Out of how many people?
Well, there were six that they took off that was dead. There's only six or eight on any of those small boats like that. They're just a gunnery boat.
And I know you're not looking for attention on that, and you're not bragging, but if you hadn't responded to his messaging and taken action, he would have died.
Yeah, he'd have died.
You saved his life.
Well, I might have, but I just happened to see him, and we're the nearest ship, and I'm sure that if he'd have come close to anybody, they would have took him.
That man survived one of the more than 26,000 casualties in the Battle of Iwo Jima, which was unfolding 76 years ago right now. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we're going to hear from a Coast Guardsman, an Army veteran, and yes, one more Marine about what they witnessed there. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU
always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special episode reflecting on the Battle of Iwo Jima through the perspectives of men from all branches of service who had converged on that tiny island 76 years ago. Remember, March 20th is the date for that special Iwo Jima Honor Walk organized by the Best Defense Foundation. You can participate wherever you're listening today, and you can sign up online right now. Check out that link at hometownheroesradio.com. I mentioned all branches of service, and often the Coast Guard gets left out. But that is the uniform Clyde McCully was wearing at Iwo Jima. 8 months earlier, he had landed troops at Normandy's Utah Beach on D-Day. At Iwo Jima, the landing craft he was operating, an LCVP from the USS Bayfield, served a different purpose.
My task there was primarily retrieving casualties and returning them to either one of the hospital vessels or our ship for attention. One of the disappointments, of course, is that you go in for a certain number of casualties and you find out that only a very few of them still had life with them. And for a good period of time, the boat that I had was used as a refueling station for the Amtraks that went in. The Marines used those quite a bit at Iwo Jima. It was an operation that just involved a tremendous amount of back and forth of vessels such as the Amtraks and the LCVPs to take ashore what really was needed. And, of course, the beach was very difficult to deal with because it was a type of volcanic ash that was very hard to gain traction on for some of the vehicles that were to be placed there. One afternoon when I went in to collect the what casualties we could find, it was so quiet. Nothing was happening. There was no mortar fire or any small arms fire that was coming into the beach at all. And sometimes I think that's worse than dodging, because you have a feeling they're just taking more careful aim.
That was Coast Guard veteran Clyde McCully. Among the Army personnel on Iwo Jima at the end of the action there was the 725th Medical Sanitation Company, a segregated unit of African-American soldiers tasked at times with cleaning up the carnage of battle. Fitzalbert Marius would go on to become a pioneering heart surgeon, but 76 years ago, his outlook, like so many others on Iwo Jima, could only handle one day at a time.
You have a war attitude that everybody is subject to soon death, including you. That's part of your everyday situation. You wake up, the more you protect yourself and the more you do right, the more potential you have of continuing another day.
And you mentioned that your duties at times included burying the dead. What was that like for you? How difficult was that? How challenging was that?
That was extremely challenging because, now, you are not talking about burying one or two people. You are talking about getting one of them big ditch diggers and digging out a big trench and then shoving in 100, 200, 300, 1,000 people and then covering them over.
Is that American? Is that Japanese? Is that both?
Both, depending on the situation. Now, with the Japanese, you didn't worry about IDs and stuff like that. But with the Americans, you make sure you got the dog tags off of them so, you know, had identities. But you're burying human beings with a bulldozer ain't fun. But you do develop a way of handling it so that you can survive, because you have to have an attitude of survival.
That was Dr. Fitzalbert Marius. And to conclude our focus on Iwo Jima today, I want you to hear from one more Marine. Ted Brodalski would go on to serve in the Air Force during the Korean War and Vietnam War, but at this point, 76 years ago, he was a 19-year-old in the 4th Marine Division.
I always kid the people that are my friends in the Navy that I'm mad at the Navy, because when I was in the Marine Corps, they told me I'd end up in the islands with palm trees, hula hula girls, and I get on this boat, and we get to this island, and they say, okay, you guys need to get off here. This is where your destination is. And by the way, this is Iwo Jima. There's 20,000 Japanese who want to kill you, and they're shooting at you. I was with the 4th Marine Division Command Post Air Liaison Section. We were aboard ship on the initial landing. The general and the staff didn't go to ashore till D plus four, and I stayed with the command post, was right below Suribachi, because when they took Suribachi, that was the fourth day. Up in that time, the Japanese were up on Suribachi in the caves and everywhere, and for the longest time, no matter where you were, with their tunneling set up, you didn't know whether they were going to show up behind you or anywhere, and so we're constantly concerned with the snipers. When we first landed, they had the whole island set up with trajectory. Their mortars and their artillery, they had the whole island pinpointed. So when they saw a bunch of troops together, they just went to their maps, took their mortars, and boom, they got right to the site. So during the whole island situation, we had 6,800 dead, 30,000 casualties. So you know that whenever they sent artillery or mortar or snipers, someone was going to go.
Well, and something tells me that some of those artillery shells ended up somewhere close to you at some point.
You know, people say, well, how did you get away without wounded or killed? And I tell them, you know, when that mortar came in, it landed 5-10 feet in front of me. The next one landed behind me. The next one to the left, one next. And that guy upstairs said it wasn't my time. That's the only thing you can say. There was no hiding. That was a volcanic ash. You couldn't dig down more than 12 inches without it coming back in. Luckily, all us guys were slim and young, so if you dug down 12 inches, that was to make sure none of your body was showing up for them to shoot at. And then later on, when we had the command post, we had sandbags and stuff. The whole time until we ended up at the end of the island, there was always activity going on. And the saddest part is when you saw the bodies coming back in the cemeteries on the beach. They just dug as low as they could, lined up the bodies and covered them over. And then later on, they extracted them to a different area. The one thing when I saw the Flag of Our Fathers, do you remember seeing that movie? We took about 30 young Marines to see the movie. I had never been to a surround theater because we never went to the theater. And I'm sitting there, and as the mortars and the artillery's coming in, you swear it's going to land right on top of you. The shooting and the volume of the thing. So when we got out, one of the young Marines says, was that realistic? I says, everything but the smell. Now, you know, when we went had to get them out of the caves, we used flamethrowers. Probably the worst smell that they'll ever smell in your life is burning flesh, and we had burning flesh all over the place. And so you can think of all the other things that have happened, and that one thing that stands out that thankfully you won't replicate in life. And all I can say is that the good Lord was with me.
And this special Iwo Jima episode would not be complete without Ted Brodalski's memory of that famous flag atop Mount Suribachi.
We were on the deck. We were waiting to go ashore, and when the flag went up, we were out on the deck, and we saw the flag go up. You heard a big hurrah from the island. There was enough noise to move the island, but it didn't defer the Japanese. They didn't stop. So right after the flag went up, the general decided it's time to move the command Post 4. So we went in right after the flag went up on the D+4.
So that was really your cue to land on Iwo Jima.
Right. It was our cue. And it was interesting because the colonel said to me, he said, by the way, he says, we have a Jeep for the command post, and you're the driver. And I saw all that going on the beach. Everything moving was getting killed. And I'm thinking, I'm going to be a Jeep driver? But we never used the Jeep. But that would might have been interesting because the way it was set up with the two fields and stuff and the way everything was done. You know, the thing that impressed me when I got ashore, you know, they had the concrete bunkers. Then they had the underground setting where they went the whole island, tunnels, okay? We bombed that thing for 90 days. You go and look at the pillboxes, and you'd see a little dent about 6 or 8 inches off the concrete. Before we went in, the Navy battleships shelled that place for 30 days. We thought when we got there, there's nothing going to be there. There's no vegetation or anything else. But they were underground. And they were up on Sirbachi in the tunnels and stuff. And the minute the guys start landing, they just come out of their holes, and we had a full force fight. And a Japanese general, there's 20,000 Japanese on the island, and a Japanese general was known to have said to him, you will fight till you die. In the meantime, kill as many Marines as you can. You're not going to go back home. So, you know, that's the kamikaze type deal on the airplanes. They fought till they were killed. And there was just a few hundred of them that were in the caves that came out. But they kept fighting until it was over.
Well, and I've got to ask you, and you mentioned the shells landing 5 feet in front of you or 5 feet behind you, but never on top of you, never where you caught any shrapnel, and you felt that God was looking out for you. Do you remember one specific day or one specific experience, whether it was that or something else, that felt to you like the closest call or put the biggest scare into you as still a teenager in 1945?
The first night that we were ashore, remember now, all the supplies are coming on shore. Ammunition is loaded. There's stacks and stacks of ammunition on the beach. Well, the first night about 8, just after dark, the Japanese hit the dump. They hit one of the dumps. You've heard of star shells. That's the shells that go up in the, they come down in a parachute, they light up. Well, that place was lit all night long from the shells. Well, by God, nobody was moving. You knew damn well that if you moved and there was someone out there, a sniper or so that was the one night that kind of got my attention that if we had been closer to the bomb dump, everything in the area was blown up. I remember that well, and that's another thing that just being at the right place at the right time caused my survival.
Amen. Well, another thing that I have to ask you, because anytime I talk to someone who was at Iwo Jima, you have to hear about a Suribachi story and also the image. The original sculpture in Washington, D.C. near Arlington National Cemetery, the Marine Corps Memorial there is so striking as it sits larger than life. When you see that, when you're just sitting here in your chair and you look over and you see that with the red, white, and blue sticking up above those soldiers, what does that mean to you? What's the significance of that image to you?
When we saw the flag go up, we were far away. We didn't see the people. But when we saw the flag go up, we thought we had won the island. So that gave everybody that extra little push saying, wow, we've captured the island. Well, we got Sirbachi, which was a bunch of caves and stuff, and we cleaned that up. But then the rest of the island is like a pork chop. The other 2 or 3 miles was where all the Japanese were in caves. And so as the troops were going forward, you think that you're cleaning them out. In the meantime, they come in back. And one of the things I remember is the first fighter squadron that landed, Air Force Night Fighter Squadron. And they landed on the first airfield. The pilots were in their tents the first night. Japanese come out of their caves and stuff and killed a dozen of them. So you were never safe. And they would crawl around all over the place. The way they hid the entrances to the tunnels, you never knew when they could come up and behind you. They had to, in the openings to the ones that the tunnels, they'd throw in the satchel charges, then they'd use the flamethrowers to get everybody away. But ironic, right below the tunnels was the raceway. They even had a hospital underground and all the ammunition and all everything, because they lived underground. So that the flag gave us a false sense of having gotten to the end, and it was, that's D+4, and we went on till the end of the month. The
battle went a lot longer than the estimates were. So when you see it, and you see the quote in Washington, D.C. at that Marine Corps Memorial, the quote on the side of it from Admiral Nimitz that says, among the Marines in the Pacific War, uncommon valor was a common virtue. What does that mean to you, and does that sound like what you saw and experienced as one of those Marines?
The Marines live by that creed. The Marines, since its inception, fought in every war and every conflict throughout the world. And the reason for the Marine Corps is a Marine will do his duty. There's never a hesitation. If the orders are to move forward, charge, and the firing is going around you, you're going to do what you have to do. The people we had on that island just kept doing their job, and that's why we were able to finally shut down the island.
The Marines, with help from the Army, Navy, Coast Guard, and Army Air Corps, secured that island 76 years ago, but the legacy lives on. And as we close, I'll mention once more, you can honor that legacy March 20th, wherever you are. Sign up for that honor walk with the Best Defense Foundation at bdf.org, or link to it from our site at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.